This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK7. And by TrekFan, it's not just a fan club, it's an adventure. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Don't miss out. Help us move toward that Star Trek future by visiting TrekFan.org. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit Trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martalker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and joining me this week, I have back with me my regular co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, Drew filled in for you last week. He sat in your seat there. I'm glad to have you back. How was your vacation?
You know, Chris, it was really good. I was in the Rockies, doing some backpacking, so I felt a little bit like I was traipsing along with the Baku. Unfortunately, I didn't have Worf or Beverly there to protect me with their phaser rifles. I was abducted, I believe, by the Sona, because we were in New Mexico. I'm not quite sure I remember everything.
Well, that explains why your face looks so stretchy tonight.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, that is not the procedures you want. I mean, I know today is my birthday, Chris, and I turned 34, but I didn't think I looked that bad.
It's never too early to start, you know, with the facial stretching there.
That's definitely the Sona's MO. They really believe that you can never start too early. You should see their babies.
Oh, God. Well, happy birthday, Matthew. I saw you got a lot of birthday wishes from listeners and Trek FM crew on Twitter today, so I hope you've had a good one.
So far, we reversed the order here, Chris, today, so that's the other thing I think that's a little off. I'm in the morning, I'm enjoying my coffee, you know, you're in the evening, and you're enjoying, you know, your nice cup of Romulan ale at the moment, and so we've kind of switch spots, so it feels a little bit like we're in some sort of alternate timeline or something going on. I don't know.
It does, and Uhura keeps running up and hugging me and kissing me, so.
Well, lucky
it is
you.
An alternate timeline.
So, I mean, I know that you love your Zoe Saldana, so I can't believe that you'd be complaining about that.
No complaints. Well, this week, you know, what we thought we would do is we wanted to bring you a secret podcast that was recorded at the highest level of Trek FM, in which the episode In the Pale Moonlight was being discussed, but that didn't quite work out. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to bring you one of the most perfect forgeries of a podcast about In the Pale Moonlight that you've ever heard.
Oh, Chris, this is exciting. I mean, we had done our best to get the original, but I didn't think that Tolar was quite up to it. So this may or may not sound as good as we had hoped.
Well, let's find out. So what we're going to do, this is the first time we've done this on The Orb. We're going to do a commentary for you today, a commentary of In the Pale Moonlight, which is right up there at the top of the list, I believe, for both of us, right, Matthew, of our favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Yes, Chris. For me, I would venture to say that this is my favorite. I think I can just watched this episode over and over again because I really appreciate the complexity, and I always get something new. I mean, I watched it again yesterday just to kind of ready myself for what I might want to say while we were commentating. And I was very impressed by how much I still get out of watching this episode and this moral dilemma.
Yeah, same here. I watched it earlier today just to refresh my memory on it before we did the commentary. So everyone, if you'd like to just queue up the episode on Netflix, on DVD, however you have the episode available, can go ahead and pause for a minute, queue that up. So if you have the episode ready, here we go in 3, 2, 1, play.
One of the things I really like about this episode, Chris, is just the way that it starts, and you know it's going to be really different. I mean, you never had a captain just kind of sitting there looking at the camera. You know, this is very much a, I think we were talking about this before we started, it's just very much a stage play, and it plays to all of Avery Brooks' strengths as an actor. And I think for me, that's one of the reasons that it works so well. And it makes me think, too, this is really what a captain's log is for, you know, to kind of record something that you don't want really anybody else to know about until history has, you know, passed you. And so you can kind of lay out something like this. It reminds me of all those secret things that you find out about the government later on, you know, way later on. So in about 200 years, right, you would find this out from Captain Sisko's released logs.
Yeah, that's the idea they had when they first started kicking around the initial ideas for this story, was to do some sort of political intrigue, some event that would rock the Alpha Quadrant if it ever got out there. And they were, of course, inspired by the Watergate scandal, amongst other things as well. And that is kind of what you're getting here, right? And, you know, Sisko has pulled this off, and I don't think he really wants to share this information with people, but he really needs to get it off his chest. This is interesting right here, Matthew. They're talking about the Cairo, and Jadzia's instructor from the academy, Leslie Wong, who at this point in time is the captain of the Cairo, is killed in a battle in the war here. Do you remember Leslie from Literary Treks recently?
Oh my gosh. Remind
she
me.
She was the first officer at the Cairo with,
oh, yes,
under Jellicoe.
Yes,
he,
yes.
He brought her,
yes,
on the ship.
Oh goodness, yeah. You're right. Oh my, I can't believe I missed that when I was watching this yesterday. That's a great callback.
It really is, you know, and I have never paid any attention to that actually until we did those Captain's Log comics on Literary Treks recently, and we had the Jellicoe comic, and then I was watching this today, and I'm like, wait a minute, Leslie Wong, she's captain of the Cairo.
That's incredible.
Great little connect.
Well, and it means that something happened to Jellicoe too, for her, yeah, to be the captain. So that's a wonderful callback. Oh goodness, I love this though. This scene where he says, you know, this is the moment, you know, he pinpoints the moment. And what I love about this episode is that in the way Sisko seems to be backed into a corner. And I think he has this realization, there's no way we're going to win this war if we don't have the Romulans come in. And, you know, we are, you know, when he talks to Vrenak later, where we are having manpower shortages, where everything is going wrong for us right now. We can't keep up with the Dominion at this point. And will it, I mean, you know, can we really rationalize what's going about to happen? And, you know, they make a really compelling argument on Sisko's side, I think, throughout this episode, that we can rationalize this. It's worth it to save billions. You know, this is where the logic of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one come in. And the danger of that logic is that you can really rationalize just about anything at that point. But here, with the motives being what they are, I think this is where the big question comes in. Is it morally right to do this? Is it okay for a couple people to die, and the self-respect of a Starfleet captain to make this work?
Yeah, well, that is the thing. And of course, we're watching at the beginning of the episode, we're at the end of the story, and then Sisko's telling it back to us. And that's definitely what he's trying to come to terms with himself as he recounts in his captain's log what's going on. And there's a great line that we'll get to later on where he does talk about the fact that men and women are dying every day in this war, and here I am still being concerned about the fine points of morality.
Mm-hmm. This is probably, I think, my favorite scene in the episode, because, man, Terry Farrell delivers in this scene. Like, the way she plays the Romulan, she turns into a completely different character, and you can imagine her having the pointy ears and the forehead, sitting there with a glass of Romulan ale. Man, she would have made an excellent Romulan.
That's what Sisko tells her coming up here.
It's so good because she is able to give that condensation in her voice. Like, I cannot stand the fact that I'm talking to you at this moment. Like, I hate you with every bit of my being. And it's just so well done.
She is very much like Vrenak when he comes on to the station later on.
Yeah, I wonder if they shot the Vrenak scenes first so she could kind of get a taste of how he was going to be, and then, you know, and then allowed her to play the scenes afterwards so that they would film this so she would kind of really mirror what Sisko's going to face. Otherwise, I just feel like she's watched a lot of Romulan episodes at this point just to get ready to do this scene because, oh my goodness, she pulls it off beautifully.
Could be. That's a good question. I don't know. I've never read anything about that. That's the kind of question you really have to ask very specifically at a convention, if Terry's there, you know, or if Michael Taylor or someone that was involved in writing this was there, you know, and find out for sure how they did that. I mean, who directed this? This was Victor Lobey. So I don't think you're going to run across him at a Star Trek Las Vegas, though, to ask that question.
Well, I think it's so interesting them doing this role play here, and Sisko is already realizing, okay, I'm going to need some kind of proof, you know, and this is where he will end up going to Garak to try and get it, and all the wheels in this story, everything snowballs for him. But the conversations that he has are what really lead this, and this is probably one of Star Trek's most talky episodes. But I can't imagine an episode being more, you know, thrilling to watch, even though I'm really just watching people talk the whole time.
The fact that Sisko goes to Garak also, I think, highlights, as you said, he is backed into a corner. He doesn't really know where to turn. He knows he needs to take action. He needs to do something. He also knows that none of the Starfleet officers are going to be able to help him do this. And so he goes to Garak, and he knows what he's doing. I think Sisko, he doesn't want to admit to himself what he's doing, but he knows.
And I think, too, it really speaks to, in some way, that Sisko trusts Garak. You know, Garak has earned the trust of the people on this station. And, you know, he is somebody that is underhanded and devious, but only when it needs to be. And by going to Garak, too, he also knows that, you know, Garak wants more than anything. You know, Garak says it. I want more than anything the Dominion gone from my homeland. And so, you know, you have a Cardassian patriot and a Starfleet officer that they want the same things. And so, you know, what a more perfect person for Sisko to go to, especially someone he knows will in the end do anything it takes. And, I think that's one of the things that kind of sets Sisko apart as a captain, is that there's a part of him that will do anything it takes to win. You know, Vrenak says later on, we both know that the Federation won't do anything it takes. And I think it's a funny statement because sitting there is the captain who will do anything it takes. Yeah. And, you know.
That's a good point about Garak and Cardassia. And wanting that to be free of the Dominion, because the working title for this episode, the original title, was Patriot. And I think that applies after, especially what you just said, that applies both to Sisko and to Garak in this situation.
And I like the use of the, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and Sisko talking about his cause being righteous. It's very much a patriotic feel to his conversation, you know, what you would expect kind of the patriots of America to say at that point, you know, George Washington or, you know, Thomas Jefferson at that kind of point. You really get that feel that they believe in the core of their being what they're doing is right. And Sisko has that feeling here. So
right here, they just got the communication that the Dominion has invaded Beta Zed. And interestingly, I always found it kind of odd that Beta Zed was the planet that they chose here, but they wanted to have a planet that would mean something to Star Trek fans. So, of course, Deanna Troi being Betazoid, it would mean something. They had thought about making it Vulcan, and as you can find out from, it's either the old AOL chats or the DS9 companion, but they wanted to make it Vulcan. And then they pulled out the last minute because they realized, you know, Vulcan has too much weight with Star Trek fans. And if the Dominion is going to conquer Vulcan, that is something totally different than one of the other worlds.
Well, and Beta Zed 2 has just enough of that Federation feel to it, you know, that it's it's a world that you always would have thought was safe, you know, and would be out of the fighting. I mean, who wants to fight Beta Zeds? They don't really seem, you know, like somebody you want to go conquer, but it just leaves you with that pit of your stomach. Okay, if they could conquer Beta Zed, they can conquer anyone worldwise, and that's very scary.
Meaning they don't care
exactly
about population. They don't care, you know, if it's a peaceful planet. They're just going to go in and take over.
I love this conversation here that you get. And, you know, Sisko isn't quite as sold out yet. You know, he's kind of willing to give up. He doesn't see any other answers. And, you know, it's Garak that has obviously kind of come up with a master plan through all of this. And... It just shows you how his mind works. I think this is a great episode for Garak as much as it is for Sisko. And watching,
definitely.
You know, watching them go at it. And I'm scared, you know, of Garak in this episode.
Garak is loving this whole thing. This is like his dream, is to mastermind a plan like this, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, two, it shows you that he's in some ways, I think, kind of missed the Obsidian Order and being able to be a part of these kind of things. And it just shows you how well and how good he was at it. But if you notice this plan, though, that he has, it's meticulous, well thought out, and well executed to the point where, you know, only the people that need to be involved are involved. And so I also think that Garak has kind of learned a little bit of something from the Federation. He's not going to be as brutal if he doesn't have to be. He's going to be more pinpointed than he might have been in the Obsidian Order. And I feel like there's something that's rubbed off after, you know, 6 years of living with the Federation here, because I feel like in the end he'd be a little more willing to be more brutal if he had to be. But this is very pinpointed, you know, just this person, this person, this person, this person, having as little people as collateral damage as possible.
But not only does he not share, you know, only those who need to know what's going on will know what's going on. He doesn't even fill Sisko in on his full plan, as we find out at the end, because there's, you know, that extra element that Garak has built into his plan to ensure success, and he knew Sisko would never go along with it, so he doesn't even reveal that to Sisko.
Well, and two, in some ways, that's the thing that I think where you see Garrick has learned something. He's protecting Sisko, you know. And I like to see that in some way Garrick has a connection with Sisko where he wants to protect this man, you know, from everything that's about to happen. And I don't,
that's a good point.
I don't think he would have done that again if, you know, this had been earlier seasons.
Yeah.
You know, this, in some way, by him doing that, he's allowed Sisko to only take so much of the blame, you know, especially with Starfleet Command giving him their blessing to this plan, and they don't even know all that's about to happen. So Garrick has taken all of that on himself, and he's willing to because he's Garrick. His morality is a little bit different. So I think that just speaks to the character of Garrick, that he actually does have more feeling towards these people than you might have thought before.
I agree, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Oh, now this guy here. What do you think about this alien?
One, I love the alien design. I think it's fantastic. But two, he is so creepy. Like, just the way he talks. I mean, he sounds like a smooth operating pimp, you know, like you just...
Oh, exactly, yeah.
He pulls that off beautifully. Like, I don't want to be anywhere near this guy. I feel like I need to take a shower just by listening to him.
Yeah, he really does.
Well,
smooth operating pimp. That's a good term for it. I like that.
Well, and it sounds... I mean... When he's doing this, oh, something special for your eyes only, you know, like, yeah. It's just the...
Maybe five or six Orion slave girls?
Ugh, I don't even know if a human can handle just one Orion slave girl, five or six, goodness.
Well, he is the Sisko, Matthew.
Well, that's true. You got me there. and then this is my favorite part. Oh, Garrick's here. Well, that's
different.
That's different. That just lets you know how scary Garrick is. There's really something about Garrick.
It also makes you wonder, what is this back history between this guy and Garrick?
Oh, definitely. I mean, they've left you hanging, a whole hanging thread here that makes you want to know what the background story is. That's fantastic writing.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's the baseball. I want Sisko's desk, personally. I just want his desk.
That is a great desk. I think of all the desks that you see in Star Trek for captains, he has the best. It's big. It's so palatial. You know, he looks like he has a pretty comfy chair. And then I love that really the only thing on it is a baseball and a little terminal. Other than that, it's just this big, massive thing sitting between you and him.
Yeah. I would have the same thing, but I would have a football instead of a baseball, and I'd have an Alabama football helmet, and otherwise just the terminal. That's
excellent.
It.
That's nice.
So this scene here is very interesting. I love how Odo recounts what happened to Sisko, because it's so detailed. It's so... Odo's narrative is very interesting. But what's coming up here, the conversation between Quark and Sisko, also highlights just how desperate Sisko is to pull off this plan to change the tide of the war for the Federation and really compromise his own ethics, I think, in order to save lives. That's his justification for everything.
Well, what I think about is interesting about the conversation between Odo and Sisko here is that Odo is willing to go along with it, too. He's willing to allow the captain to... He knows what's about to happen. And Odo doesn't really seem to have any problems with it. And Odo's really perceptive here. And I think this scene is... You can just see the anguish in Brooks's face as he's having to go against everything that he ever thought he would do to make this happen. And honestly, Quark lets him get off pretty easily. I mean, it really isn't that much. I mean, Quark really could have stuck it to Sisko, and he doesn't.
I agree, yeah. When he says 5 bars of gold-pressed latinum, I was thinking, only 5? I would have expected Quark to ask for a whole lot more than 5 bars of gold-pressed latinum.
Yeah, the first time you see this, you're thinking Quark's probably going to be asking for 25 to 30 bars of gold-pressed latinum, plus, you know, his clothes reimbursed, plus, you know, all these other things. And really, this is...
Set me up with Kira.
Exactly. you know, I've always wanted Dax. I don't care what Worf says, but I want one night.
Yeah, these are pretty petty little requests that Quark has, though, aren't they?
Well,
shipments being held up. It
does make me wonder, is Quark realizing that something more important is going on? The only reason that Sisko would ask me this is that there's something that is behind all this.
I think so.
I need to be reasonable in some ways for him. And you can see, you know, Quark, any other Ferengi would have just kind of destroyed Sisko with demands.
Yeah.
You know, Quark, on the other hand, you really see his character, I think, in that scene.
I'm sure Quark picks up that something's going on because, A, the captain would never ask me to do this otherwise if there wasn't something really important here. And also, Quark's very perceptive in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is great, this delivery right here.
It's so good, and I love the way they bring it back to the baseball metaphor. I got to keep my eye on the ball, and that he has clear priorities of keeping the Alpha Quadrant safe. And I think it goes back to what he'll tell Vrenak later. You know, what do you think is going to happen if we lose? You know, I know exactly what's going to happen, and it's true. The Dominion is just going to run you over because you're surrounded. I think the Romulan idea of just kind of sitting back and allowing themselves to be surrounded is really short-sighted.
Oh, Sisko definitely has a good point and the correct point for the Romulans. No doubt. Although I asked myself at one point, it was when, at the beginning of the episode, when Sisko and Dax are role-playing, you know, the future discussion with the Romulans. And I was thinking, does Sisko really believe that this is in the best interest of the Romulans? Or is he just trying to convince himself that it's in the best interest of the Romulans so that he can move forward with his plan? But I think he does sincerely believe, as I think you and I do, that, yes, in this situation, it is in the best interest of the Romulans to get involved in the war, because they would be next, no doubt.
Well, and they make the point, and I think that it's really important, you know, the Dominion is already going against their non-aggression pact with the Romulans. They are skirting in and out of their territory all the time,
right.
And the Romulans are turning a blind eye because it's keeping them out of the war. At the same time, it's showing the blatant disregard that the Dominion has for people that aren't really on its side. I mean, it's the same way that it's just using Cardassia, you know?
Yeah.
It's using Cardassia as a war machine.
This scene right here is very interesting, too, where Sisko says, fine, let's just forget about it. And then he pauses and he's, okay, well, look, you know, 200, that's a little bit much, but he realizes, like, he can't back out. He wants to back out, I think. Like, this is a line he doesn't want to cross.
Well, and it made me...
like Bashir says here, you know, you could use this to make biogenic weapons. And Sisko knows that. And this is, like, a line he doesn't want to cross. But then he catches himself and he's like, no, this is a line I have to cross because... Even if someone made biogenic weapons out of this stuff, okay, they could be used to kill some people, but we're talking about millions or billions of people
right.
who can potentially die in this war.
Well, in the way that he then delivers that line, ops, it's just, you can tell his soul is disturbed. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking, though, in this scene, I was just thinking, why don't you just put, you know, some sort of untrackable tracking device in the biomimetic gel so that you can capture then the guy who you gave it to, you know, so double cross him. I mean, might as well. It's not really that underhanded. I mean, the guy's asking for something he can use to make biogenic weapons. So why you wouldn't do that as Starfleet intelligence.
You could just have Odo pose as one of the packs of Jill.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't understand why that wouldn't be the case. So I didn't necessarily see anything wrong with going to hand over biomimetic gel when there's so many different ways that you can handle, you know, capturing that person.
Right, right. Now, here's Jeffrey Combs. He is everywhere. He's even in this episode. You know, an interesting point about this episode is this is the second episode in a row where we get to see Wei-Oon, but we see him as a hologram. I just thought that was a nice little interesting bit of trivia.
Well, and I love that they talk about the program, and he's like, all I needed to do was add a little bit of petty bickering. Yes. And mutual self-loathing, and it just makes, yes, it real, you know, which is so true, because these characters,
so true.
The bickering back, yeah, and forth is perfect.
Yeah. It's so true. Yeah.
I think, Chris, I was thinking about this the other day when I was watching the episode. I think that this may be the best bottle episode ever created. Like, they only use existing sets.
Yeah.
So this episode probably didn't cost them a ton of money. But
well, like
I can't
you said
think
at the
of a
beginning,
better one.
This is really like a stage play. You know, this, and any bottle episode, if it's set up like a stage play, it can work really, really well.
Well, and I,
this guy, who gets it? just put it in the case. You don't need to know.
And stop talking. This is the point I realized yesterday too. This turns into Star Wars, where he goes, "I'm altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any farther." Sisko turns into Darth Vader at this moment, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, it's very Darth Vader-ish.
Yeah. Avery Brooks is so good in this episode. I mean, you know, you think of great moments from the different actors in the different series, the different captains. But, boy, Avery is just so good in this episode.
Well, and Chris, we did discuss this a little bit before we recorded, but do you think any of the other captains could pull off this role? I mean, just the actors to make you feel this episode the way that Avery does?
I don't know. Like, okay, so the scene that we just watched right there where Benjamin has Tolar pinned against the wall, of course Patrick Stewart could pull that off with like kind of that same energy and that same anger. We've seen him do it, definitely. But when you flip it around to scenes like this one here, recording the log, the anguish that Sisko is feeling, You can sense the gears churning in his head as he's trying to come to terms with this. This is something that I personally feel is such Avery Brooks here, as much as it is Sisko. I have a hard time seeing any of the other captains, any of the other actors, pulling this entire package off in the way that Avery Brooks does here.
I tend to agree with you, Chris. You know, I think that especially the angry scenes, if I hadn't seen Stewart in First Contact really deliver those lines with just the menace that he does and the,
yeah,
you know, Picard really, I think, in First Contact to me becomes a real person because he's somebody who's deeply affected by what's happened to him. And this is one of those episodes where, you know, Sisko is deeply affected by what's going on and you see it the whole time. So I definitely think Stewart could have pulled this off. And this might sound weird, but I could imagine even Bakula doing this. I would have loved to have seen an episode like this for Archer. And you kind of get that in Home when they come home. And that just his whole countenance is completely different. And I think that's probably Archer's best episode is Home because
of that. Yeah, I was going to say like post-Zindi arc Archer, mm-hmm. I can see him doing something like that because the Zindi arc really turned him into a somewhat Sisko-like captain. I mean, not quite as extreme as Sisko can be, but definitely more like Sisko than say
exactly.
Picard.
Well, and then that fourth season, I think that Archer and Sisko are very similar because mm-hmm. he's just no nonsense and really he will do anything it takes, but he's also trying to do it in a way that doesn't hurt his conscience anymore. And you know, Sisko, I think, is the same way. And so that's a great parallel, I think, between those two captains. I'll let you and Kate talk about that more in Warp 5 sometime.
This was interesting here, having a Romulan shuttle decloak inside the docking bay here.
It was such a nice touch, too, because I think for a second, Garak's like, are they here? And then Sisko just gives him that like knowing look, like, don't you realize they're just cloaked on right. purpose? I think it's really good.
Now, here comes Vrenak, who has, he's got some lush hair, doesn't he?
You know, this guy is amazing. I mean, he's got lush hair. He also delivers every single line perfectly. Like, he's matching the energy he's getting from Brooks.
Yeah.
And this conversation, this general self-loathing that they have for each other is amazing. I just thought you'd be taller.
Now, we were just talking about Enterprise, and this is Stephen McCaddy, who's playing Vrenak here, and he was actually the alien foreman in the Zindi, the episode called the Zindi, during the third season of Enterprise. So we do see him later on in Star Trek. But, Vrenak, he comes out, and he's quite an ass, isn't he?
He's just a Romulan, I think, which is by definition...
Don't you think he's a bigger ass than the average Romulan?
You know, I guess in some ways you're right. I mean, you see some Romulans, especially like in Nemesis, you have Denatra, who's quite a kind Romulan. As Romulans
go. Come on, I'd like to take her out on a date. What are you talking about?
Yeah, she's
nothing like Vrenak.
Yeah, I think Vrenak is probably what we think of as the quintessential Romulan. You know, just
maybe.
He has all the smugness that y'all were talking about Vulcans in the last Ready Room, plus all of the arrogance that goes along with being a Romulan, and just the general hate for anybody else that's not a Romulan.
Yeah. And he's got that kind of that cultural arrogance that I think works well with the Romulans too here, where he's criticizing the synthesized drink, but then he kind of warms up to it. I think he's just playing Sisko here.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really nuanced performance, so that, you know, every time you might get a little bit something different from it. You know, you might think one time while you're watching this episode that he's kind of coming around and at least listening, and then another time you might watch it and think, you know, he just doesn't. He's not into this at all. He's just here for the party, you know, just to see what's going on. So.
It really is a good replication. I like how this foreshadows later on when he watches the holographic simulation, and then he checks out the data ride, and he says of the drink here that it's really a good replication, but I almost thought it was the real thing, but only for a moment.
It is definitely a good mirror for what is about to happen. It's great foreshadowing writing. They're definitely playing along that. It's interesting watching him watch here, and he's just kind of walking around, walking inside the characters, and I feel like that, you know, he, in his mind, in his Romulan mind, he can definitely buy that this would probably be happening in the Dominion, because it's exactly what the Romulans would be doing if they were on right. the reverse. And so it's not so hard and out of the ordinary for him to think, okay, this could definitely be happening on Cardassia Prime.
And it's proper due diligence on his part to want to examine the rod as well. I mean, you wouldn't want to just, especially we've seen in real life how, you know, supposed military intelligence gets in the hands of leaders and military leaders, and they jump to conclusions and they make decisions and they actually take action mm-hmm. sometimes on what turns out to be false information. So definitely you would want to examine this rod. I mean, it's not at all an unreasonable request here by Vrinak.
Well, and it's a little bit interesting. I mean, you know, just getting a little bit political for a second, you think of back to the Iraq War, and everybody in the world thought that that information was correct. You know, there wasn't anybody who didn't think that information was correct.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, for Vrinak, he's able to figure out that this is a fake. But nobody in our world could figure that out. And just the difference there. So, you know, Chris,
what is that that Sisko's, is that Beefeater that Sisko is pouring right there?
I was going to say like it was, it's probably some really good rye that just comes from down in South Louisiana from his dad. I feel like they probably know somebody who still makes a little, homemade, homespun gin or something like that. Maybe it's Argyle's label.
Oh, could be. Could be. I just love these scenes of Sisko sitting here drinking and by himself in his quarters. As we talked about how he, you know, slowly breaks down the First Contact / DS9 uniform.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is that you realize, okay, this is a man who's not drinking synthahol. I mean, he's pulled out a real bottle of alcohol here. And just prop-wise, I love this glass that he's drinking out of. It's so intricate.
Yeah.
He just takes that sip, and you can tell it doesn't make him feel better like he hoped it would.
Yeah.
So, Chris, it would be important for us a little bit I need to ask you, do you think from this episode and what he just said, the cost being too high, do you think it's worth it? Is this, in the end, the morally right decision or the only decision that Sisko can really make at this point?
That's a difficult question. Here's the famous scene. Look how uncomfortable Sisko is.
It's a fake! Ugh, what a great meme.
Classic.
It's so awesome.
You know, when Stephen McHattie took this role and he delivered that line, he did not know that he would be creating one of the most classic moments in Star Trek, did he?
I don't think so. It's really probably the most fantastic thing. Because everyone can do it. I mean, if you haven't seen Star Trek, you've seen that meme, you know, rolling around. It's a fake!
Well, we were watching television last night, and they were showing these people who had what they thought was a book from the Edo period here in Japan. And they thought the book was very, very valuable. And they had it examined. They had it all checked out. And they found out, they said, no, it's only worth about 1,000 yen or about $10 because it's a fake. And as I'm watching it, I was hearing Vrinak in my head holding up the book going, it's a fake. But to take you back real quick to your question, I mean, is it morally the right thing to do? Is it ethically the right thing to do? It's a really, really hard question to answer. I don't know. I mean, I think in the end, Sisko is not concerned about the welfare of the Romulans. Of course, he's concerned about the welfare of the Federation more than anything. And he knows that if he can get the Romulans in the war, having that extra manpower, having that extra technology on their side, and it's just a numbers game. As we see, you know, later on in Statistical Probabilities, maybe it will turn the war in their favor. Boy, it's hard to say. I mean, what would you do if you were in his shoes? Would you betray your own ethics if you knew that it might save billions of lives? I mean, I think I probably would.
You know, Chris, I take a little bit different, just a little bit different stance in the sense that I think that Sisko is worrying about the Alpha Quadrant, not just the Federation. And I see that worry in him. And I think it comes from the fact that he's been involved with the Bajorans so long. And so he's thinking not just about the Federation, but he's thinking about the Bajoran system, which he's come to love. He's thinking about the fact that, you know, something like Beta Zed has just been taken over. They might be part of the Federation, but they're not human. I think he's even thinking about the Cardassians. I think he is thinking about the Romulans, the Klingons, all of these people that are just about to be run over if the Dominion wins, that a whole way of freedom and life is going to be lost, in much the same way that the American Patriots saw their freedom slipping away and they felt like they had to fight for it. And so I really take that Sisko is thinking about the grander picture. And I think that plays out later when he's Admiral Ross's attaché and working, because you can see that Sisko is able to think bigger picture than just the small, you know, my ship, my station. And so that's why, for me, when I watch this episode, I always think that Sisko is making the right choice, because he's thinking about the larger picture. He's thinking about the future. What would the future be like if the Dominion ruled not only the Gamma Quadrant, but the Alpha Quadrant, and how dangerous that, and what a loss that would be. And so for me, I struggle with the episode every time I watch it, but I always think in the end that he makes the right decision.
Interesting point. Yeah. So if you were in his shoes, you would make the same decision.
I think so. That's a hard
to it's
say.
It's hard to say for sure, yeah. Right? Like, we don't know for sure what we would do, but it just seems in the end, I mean, in the end, Sisko, in a way, he's sacrificing himself, right? He's sacrificing his many of his own principles for the greater good.
Well, and I think there is the realization in him that, and it comes down to, will he... It's kind of a superhero question, you know. Do I kill the villain to save millions of lives, you know? And that's really that question that he has. Do I do this at a sacrifice, maybe to myself? And I, you know, it's still a question that we're debating. I mean, obviously, Man of Steel has had this question, because of Superman killing Zod. Spoiler alert. And this is the same question that he has.
Yeah. And here's the great ending.
I like that he doesn't leave out what he's done.
And the great part here are the inflections when he says, "I can live with it." He's still trying to convince himself.
I do think that he is struggling with that idea of, and he's trying, I think, thinking through this whole episode, was there anything else that I could have done as he's telling the story? And I like that he doesn't take a drink. Like, he just sets it down. He's kind of disgusted. Mm-hmm. And he's realizing, I have to live with it. I don't have a choice.
Yeah.
because I already made the choice.
That inflection right there, I think really sums up what's going on in his head.
Now, Chris, I also have to say this is the best reset button use ever.
Yes.
You know, this is an episode that, you know, you wouldn't know about it happening unless Sisko makes his log. But it's the best use of the reset button in the sense that nobody else will know this happened. You know, we just got the ability to peek into Sisko's mind.
Right. Because, I mean, it's not a reset button in a sense. It doesn't change the fact that all this happened.
Right.
It just changes the fact that it was recorded and that anyone will ever know. So only right. We know, as the viewers, what really happened. Starfleet, his crew, everyone else, they don't know. You know, Garrick knows, and Sisko knows what really happened, and that's pretty much it.
Well, and it's really great that, you know, Starfleet knows some of it. They don't know all of it, and I think that makes a really good, I don't know, it just makes it really realistic, you know, that there's, the government might say something is okay to do, but the actual pulling it all off and how everything worked and exactly what happened, not everybody knows. And that's really, really interesting to look at.
That's one thing as we wrap up here, now the episode has ended, that I did want to ask you that we didn't touch on when it came up during the episode. The fact that Starfleet has given their blessings to the plan. First of all, I mean, what did you think about that? And how much of the plan do you think Sisko actually told Starfleet? Did he just tell them that, I'm going to try to bring the Romulans into the war? Are you good with that? Or did he tell them, we're going to fabricate this meeting between Wayoon and Damar, and we're going to possibly kill a Romulan senator? What do you think they knew? It was wild that Starfleet would sign off on something like this.
Well, Chris, I came to the thought that, you know, Starfleet also still knows that Section 31 is around, and they're okay with that. And I think it showed the desperation of Starfleet.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, yeah.
And I think that's really what this whole episode is about, is that do you do everything you can to protect your way of life, even if it crosses some boundaries, and leaves us still with that question. I mean, we're not going to answer that for anyone. So,
yeah, ultimately, that is what this is about, and it applies to real life today as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about after 9/11, how things have changed in the world and how things have changed in the United States in the name of protecting our way of life, as we say. And it's the same thing here. I mean, what would the Federation do? And it reminds me in past tense when Bashir is talking about how do we react, you know, when push comes to shove? Do we stand firm with our principles, or do we fall into anarchy? You know, do we betray our principles? And that's what, you know, we wonder in the real world today, and totally what Sisko was dealing with here, and what the Federation, what Starfleet was dealing with in sanctioning this kind of operation in the first place.
One, but you know, that's what you know, Ross says to Bashir, and that he quotes the Latin phrase, you know, that in the time of war, law goes silent. That idea that Starfleet is being pushed to this boundary. And I think that's really what made Deep Space Nine so great, is it challenges Roddenberry's utopianism by saying what happens to that utopianism when it may end. And it really makes you question that, and can you really live by that? And it gives you so much to think about. And so just one of the beauties of this show, and I think really why it's starting to see fans are starting to see that it stands the test of time, this show, because it's asking universal questions in a way that some of the other series didn't. And I really appreciate that, you know, this is an episode that we'll probably talk about again on the Orb because of its complexity.
I'm sure we'll talk about it again. Yeah. Because one thing we didn't touch on at all in here, because it didn't really, you know, work with the commentary, was the original concepts of the episode. And, you know, many of them involved Jake. Some of them originally didn't involve Sisko at all. And so I think we'll talk about that on a future show when we can kind of delve into that a little bit more. But I hope everyone enjoyed the commentary and our look at In the Pale Moonlight. It is a fan favorite, you know, and most people consider it the darkest episode of Star Trek for many of the series. And I think that's probably true. And as you just said, Matthew, it really challenges Roddenberry's entire concept of the future. But I think it's very true to Deep Space Nine because it challenges it in a way that represents reality and real life in a way that we can connect to. And also, I think in a way that will remain true even in the 24th century, because I mean, I hope we overcome all this stuff, but in reality, I don't know, you know, things will get better. Life will get better. Technology will get better, but basic human instincts, humanoid instincts, even changeling instincts in the case of the Dominion, you know, those are not, those things are just not going to go away, I don't think.
Definitely. And I think it leads you to realize that moral quandary is always going to be a moral quandary. And the reason that is because as much as humans progress, these things are still going to be front and center and important to us. I like that Star Trek helps us ask those questions by playing out some sort of tale in the future and making us look at ourselves. And that's what it always does best, I think, at its best. I think this is an episode that, as much as some fans really disliked it because of where Sisko ended up and what he ended up doing, you can't help but just enjoy and be thankful that it's making you ask these really tough questions.
Most definitely. Well, Matthew, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on In the Pale Moonlight. And I'll be surprised if we don't get some feedback from this episode, because there is so much in here to talk about. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb. And that will come to Matthew and me by email. If you'd like to join in our forums and talk about this episode, you can do that at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the orb, and there's one for Deep Space Nine. We'd love to have you come there, talk to us and other listeners about Sisko's decisions, about In the Pale Moonlight. Again, trek.fm/forums. If you'd like to send us a voicemail, you can easily do that from any page on the website. Just look along the right side of any page and you'll see a tab that says Send Voicemail. If you click that, a box will pop up, and from there you can use your webcam's microphone to record a message, and you can upload it to us as an MP3 file, and we would love to hear from you that way. If you're on Facebook, you'll find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And on Twitter, you'll find us tweeting about Trek all the time under username trekfm. And Matthew, what if listeners would like to talk to you personally? Where should they go?
Well, Chris, there's a couple of places. One is Twitter, of course, with MattRushing02. Love to talk to you about and just whatever is going on, Star Trek movies, books, all that kind of stuff. And so give me a follow, give me an app by, and we'll have a great conversation, hopefully. Two, you can find me doing Literary Treks with you every week, where we talk about books and comics, diving into that universe. So much fun. I had a great time listening to your conversation with Larry, which was fascinating last week. So if you guys missed that, go find that out, because there's some great new stuff coming out in the books and comics universe, and especially the resurgence of nonfiction in Star Trek. So that's was excellent. And then if you just want to see me personally just writing other things, reviews, my own thoughts, I have my own blog. It's 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. So you can check that out as well. Now, Chris, if we want to find you where you're not a fake, where can we find you?
Yeah. Well, if you want to see the fake me, go to Twitter and look under the username big C, Brian Jones. There's six A's in there. No, I'm kidding. That's not a real account. You can find me under username C, Brian Jones. That's the letter C, and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. And, you know, give me a follow, say hello, chat me up about Star Trek. I'd love to talk to you about Star Trek or college football or music or whatever. If you have questions about Japan, I'll answer those too. Just find me there on Twitter. If you'd like to find me elsewhere on the network, besides Literary Treks with Matthew, you can find me on The Ready Room every week, where we talk about DS9, yes, but also the other four live-action series as well. And if you're an Enterprise fan, you can now find me every week with Kate Walsh on Warp 5. We've had two shows. Actually, by the time this episode of The Orb drops, three shows. We had associate producer Dave Rossi on the first one. And in our second episode, we sat down with show creator Brandon Braga. So some very interesting stuff there for you to listen to. And Matthew, like you, I have my own website as well. If you'd like to read some of my writing about things other than Star Trek, look at my photos, find out what kind of music I like and such, you can find me at cbrianjones.com. Very easy to remember. And Matthew, before we let everyone go, we would like to ask everyone to please support our sponsors for this week's show. This helps us bring the programming to you every week. First of all, there's Squarespace, which is the best web hosting and CMS that you'll find anywhere. It makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, really anything you can imagine. And actually, if you listen to this week's Ready Room, you'll find out about Daniel's plan for a Star Trek Pokemon website using Squarespace. But, you know, create your own space. I promise you're going to love it. I certainly do. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial and use offer code TREK7 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And also, please visit trekfan.org. It's an amazing chance for you to come together with fans to do more than just talk about Star Trek. Now, Matthew, we love to talk about Star Trek, right? To sit around.
Yes, we do.
Record our podcast. You know, we love to talk about Star Trek. But really, if we're going to get to that Star Trek future, we need to be more active. You know, we need to be solving problems. We need to be moving the world forward towards the 23rd century, the 24th century. And that's what you can do at trekfan.org. You can collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives. And you can turn your love for Star Trek into something that can help us move towards that great future. So support us and support Trek Fan by visiting trekfan.org. Go to the website, solve that first puzzle, and take the next step on your adventure. And lastly, if you would personally like to support the network, we have a way you can do that now as well. You can go to trek.fm/donate, and we have 8 new alien-themed badges as a thank you for your contributions. And these are perfect for your shirt or your bag or your dress uniform, or in the case of In the Pale Moonlight, your vest, you know, that goes underneath your big heavy wool DS9 First Contact uniform. So you can go get those. They are 44mm badges. They have original illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the art that you see on our website. There are different levels of contributions that you can make. So just go over to trek.fm/donate and make a contribution. And that helps us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that is needed to bring the orb to you every week. And we really appreciate your support and that of Squarespace and Trek Fan.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. And we will see you next time when we gaze into the orb.